Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard, and tonight's going to be a fun one. I am joined tonight by the illustrious Dr. Greg Gillespie, a two-time winner of the Three Castles Award, the creator of Barrow Maze. This will be a fun conversation. I'm super excited to talk about mega dungeons, to talk about barrows, talk about, you know, bringing that historical concept into role-playing games. This is going to be a great conversation. Before we get into that, though, first thing I want to say right off the bat, tonight we are talking explicitly about Mega Dungeons, Barrow Maze, Greg's career. That's what we're discussing tonight. I know there's been other nonsense going on in the gaming world. We're not talking about that. And if it becomes a persistent issue in chat, I don't usually do this, but I will start banning people if certain things are brought up. So with that out of the way, real quick, I just want to remind everyone to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you're seeing here on Rollin' Bones. You know, I love doing this show and I want to bring it to more and more people. So definitely like, share, and subscribe when you see that. And also you can find me on the various social media here on Twitter and Instagram. I am at Howard_RyanGreg. YouTube is Rollin' Bones and Twitch is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. You can also now find me on Substack, which is at rollinbones.substack.com. I'm gonna go ahead and drop that one in chat for you guys. Substack is really where my articles have been migrated to. I am working on bringing over the archive of all of those Twitter threads that I did. Let me go ahead and show you guys what my Substack looks like. Bonehead Ideas from Ryan Howard. This is something that I've really enjoyed doing. And, you know, just yesterday I did a post on duels and single combat, which I hope you guys will read and, you know, let me know your thoughts on. Also want to remind everyone that you can buy Rollin' Bones merch on my T Public store, which I just meant to share but did not. Bring that back up here. So yeah, my T Public store. This is where you can find such great designs as the Rollin' Bones logo t-shirt, the Bonehead t-shirt and hoodie, which you saw Levi Combs rocking at North Texas RPG Convention. And I'm actually going to be retiring the RP Gorillas design. I'm going to be replacing it with a new design that I will announce in 2 weeks. So that is it for my stuff. Thank you to everyone who supports me on both of those platforms. You know, those of you who bought t-shirts, I really appreciate it. But that's enough of me shilling stuff. Let's bring on the person you guys are here to see, two-time winner of the Three Castles Award, the creator and designer of Barrow Maze. He is a professor on top of all that. Ladies and gentlemen, the multi-talented Greg Gillespie. Greg, welcome to Rollin' Bones.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem at all. Thanks for coming on. So everyone who comes on Rollin' Bones gets asked the same two questions at the top of the show, and this is really just kind of the beginning here. So let's begin at your beginning. How did you get into role-playing games to start?
In terms of my play experience?
Yeah.
Well, in public school, I had a friend that was talking about this really cool game. And his friend played it over in his basement. So I was invited over the on the weekend and went to my friend's house, and then we walked down to his friend's house, who in the basement they had a whole bunch of kids, and they had this huge table set up in the basement, and in the center of this table was this big, huge, like, fruit bowl, and it was filled with polyhedral dice.
Oh, nice.
And I was instantly hooked. As soon as I saw that big, huge bowl of strange dice, I was like, I've got to learn all about this. And then from there, it was onto Moldvay Basic, and then eventually AD&D, and then second edition, and so on.
Gotcha. So that first game that you guys were playing, which version was that?
That would have been BX, okay. Although the AD&D was coming in hot, and we were very excited, as everyone was at that time, to move to AD&D and with the Monster Manual and Player's Handbook and so on. And we didn't really, like a lot of people, we didn't really understand the high Gygaxian that was going on and the descriptions of all the various different types of pole arms. But that was all impetus to go and learn about those things. And so it was really, that was the gateway drug.
Gotcha. Now, those of us who devote a lot of time, either, through these shows or writing books or teaching courses on role-playing games like you do, we do this out of a love for the game. And I feel like that love comes from the fond memories we have of playing and running the games for our friends. So if you had to pick a fondest RPG memory, what would that be?
Some of my fondest RPG memories were playing some of the Dragonlance modules with a couple of my friends in our public school library. Mm-hmm. And so we would take the pre-generated characters, and we would fight over who would get to play Caramon or Sturm Brightblade. And then we'd poke fun at whoever had to play Tasselhoff Burfoot.
As you should.
Yeah. So those are some of the fond memories that we had. And then, of course, making our own sort of like Monty Hall dungeons, where you'd have Tiamat in one room just waiting there to be killed. And, giants in the next room and so on. Just very, very school D&D, I guess you'd say, at that time, trying to make sense of all the rules and whatnot, doing the best we could.
Gotcha. So I'm going to start with this just because you've recently come back from a trip to the UK, and I saw some of the pictures you were posting of actual barrows that you were visiting. So I have to ask, just for the sake of anyone out there who doesn't know, can you explain what the concept of a barrow is historically?
Sure. So there are many different types of barrows or cairns that come from the time after we get the creation of agriculture. Mm-hmm. And as that spreads through Europe and then eventually across to the UK and Ireland, people, when they've had access to agriculture and their populations increase, that's when you get the creation of these megalithic passage tombs. And so there have to be some cultural things in place to allow a group of people, a community of people, to spend the inordinate amount of time to create a cairn or a burial mound. And then, of course, they're very close to the agrarian cycle. So we've got a number. Anytime I would go to these barrows, the ones you mentioned, I would always stand immediately in front of the entrance and pull up my compass just to see where the orientation of the opening would be set. Would it be to the winter solstice? Would it be to the equinox? Where would the potential orientation be? Because that was all very carefully considered. So a barrow would be a place that you would inter remains. Usually it would be like a status burial for the god kings or chieftains. It would be for important people in a given community. And a lot of the times the stone is being carried over miles. So you know, these were things that were carried out over a long period of time. So they would take the stone and then they would have to drag it up a hill. And then, and that hill would not only mark that territory as yours, but it'd be high up, closer to the gods, to the heavens, if you will. And then you would be able to see from the hill where your community would perform its rituals. You would be able to see further down into the valley across to another hill where there might be another community of people building their cairns or later on ring forts or whatever they may be. So there's a lot of really interesting history that gets overlapped. So a site might be used as a ritual place, and then there might be a cairn put over top of that, and then there might be a satellite mounds, and then those mounds might be encompassed or umbrellaed within a larger mound. So that's the really interesting thing about history in the UK, is that you get layers, right? Yeah. And so oftentimes when archaeologists go and they start excavating a barrow, one of the first things they're going to find are going to be Roman coins.
Yeah.
Particularly if the barrow was located near a road, because the Romans, when they had their span of time in the UK, they would often, if they went by a barrow, they would put a coin and bury it under the dirt, just as a, you know, a luck thing, as an offering. And so, you know, you get some interesting things developed when you look at the archaeology around barrows, and there's always new stuff coming forward. And then of course, with DNA testing, they can get a sense as to, you know, where did these people actually come from? So that's all, I think, really interesting detail. And Dungeons and Dragons, even if you like, I'm a vanilla medieval fantasy guy. Like, that's my wheelhouse for Dungeons and Dragons. And if you like that kind of thing, and you look back at TSR modules and then even more recent stuff, it's all like kind of post-apocalyptic. There are layers of civilizations that, you know, once existed that provide the impetus for you to go dungeoneering in a given, you know, locale or some ancient temple or catacomb or barrow or whatever it might be. So I think it all fits really neatly over top and makes for interesting gaming.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's something to be said for incorporating as much kind of real world detail into a game as you can. I also like kind of that vanilla medieval fantasy aspect as well. I really like incorporating historical things into my games, just because it's a little bit of reality that players can latch onto and know this is not quite one-to-one, but very heavily based on something real, something that I could go visit theoretically. And so it just gives an extra bit of life to your game, having those details.
It grounds it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And like, we've all looked at fantasy product in role-playing games, and you know, it might have an interesting idea. Some of the art might be okay, but you look at it and it's like, It's gone too far. It's in the fantastical rather than being grounded in medieval fantasy. And I think one of the ways that you can do that, so like I do a lot of hunting in history and archaeology, and when I find either, say, a sketch from the 19th century or a historical photograph or something like that, I'll often use that with an artist as a reference point. And so you can, in some instances, I'll have a one-to-one. So if you see a full page illustration in one of my books, odds are that came from either an engraving or a historical photograph or a picture I've taken with trying to incorporate the experience while grounding the sense of the game. Mm-hmm.
And another element that I kind of want to ask about, the name Gillespie is Scots Gaelic in origin, if I'm not mistaken. So there's a personal familial connection to this specific topic as well.
Yeah. So, you know, my parents are Scots, and they came to Southern Ontario in the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so like having an interest in my family heritage and Celtic ancestry and Anglo-Saxon ancestry has always been important to me. It's important to the games I create. It was important to the historical research that I did prior to publishing creatively. So it's all part and parcel for me. And I think when speaking, just joining those two things, when you've got something that's historically grounded and is grounded personally, then like you're incorporating, those are two of my ancestry and historical and archaeological research. Those are two of my passions alongside fantasy adventure. And so when I get to combine those three things, now I'm right in my wheelhouse. And I think, or I like to hope, that that comes off the page when people take a look at Barrow Maze or they take a look at Dwero Deep or what have you.
And see, there's a connection for me as well, because my family is Ulster Scots and some Highland Scots as well. I'm related to the MacLeans of, I believe they're on the Isle of Mull is where my specific Highland heritage comes from. But I'm also related to the same Ulster Scots that Robert E. Howard was related to. So there, I share a little bit of that ancestry. I have not had the opportunity to go there and see kind of the sites that you've seen, though. So that's something I'd very much like to do someday.
Well, I was really off the beaten path. Like if it was in the wheelhouse of, you could, like a tourist bus could drive up to it, I wasn't there. I was off in the countryside, you know, traipsing through farmers' fields to look at dolmens and things of that nature that are really, you know, some of the roof stones on these things. Like one I looked at, they actually excavated a site in 2015, and one of the reasons they did that is the roof stone on this dolmen was going to fall off, and so they brought in a tractor to be able to lift the top stone, and the top stone was 14 ton. Just the top stone alone. And when you look at this thing, it was like something that a glacier had deposited in a past ice age. And then the Neolithic farmers saw it and they're like, okay, we're going to use that. And so it was really set in the landscape. It was really stunning. And it's just in somebody's like farmer's field. And they had like a turnstile that you could go onto their lawn and go go past their house. And so, I was like hesitant to do, I don't want to be, you know, that guy, but I did see this woman unloading groceries and I just hailed her and I said, would I be able to come and take a look at your structure? And they're like, oh yeah, we, that's why we put the turnstile in. that way you can go in and look, but the animals can't get out. They were super nice about it. And what was really, really cool is that when they did the excavation of that particular dolmen, they found like Iron Age remains. And then they went down and they found like some Neolithic items like flint axes and knives and things. And then they'll go below that so they can just test the soil to see, you know, they can extrapolate from carbon dating and stuff. So they'll go all the way through the different layers to figure things out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and people forget just how much history there is located in the UK specifically. Just civilizations on top of civilizations, people who conquered other people, all right on this just series of islands. And yeah, there have been more people on those islands than anyone even remembers at this point. So it really is just kind of a fascinating place to discover mysteries and things lost to time that serve as ammunition for these games that we play.
For sure. Like when you're standing in front of a structure that was built, you know, 5,700 years ago.
Yeah.
And is perfectly aligned to the winter solstice. It makes you reflect on how closely people lived with the land.
Yeah.
And then in this kind of hypermobile, rootless digital existence that we live in for the most part, mm-hmm. it makes you think, you know, have we gained more or have we lost more?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it was a question I considered at multiple points when you see the ingenuity to be able to move a 14-ton stone with just human beings. Mm-hmm. Like it's absolutely remarkable, some of the things that these people accomplished. So there's a lot of like thought. And of course, if you wanted most of these passages, these passage tombs are, well, given a certain time period, they're cruciform, right? So you've got a long passage, and then you'll have a chamber to the left, one forward, and then one to the right. And anything in those areas would have had to been situated before it was built, right? Yep. Then you would build the walls around it. Then you would put the ceiling stone on top of it. Then you'd bring the mound on top of it. So a great deal of forethought. And in some instances, you're dealing with huge pieces of granite that were placed there long before the structure or passage was built.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one thing that I love about this is you take a very academic approach to role-playing games. And this is, of course, because you yourself are an academic. So I want to kind of pose a question to you. In the early days of role-playing games, there were a lot of master's students and you know, university students who were playing this game and were kind of informing the early ways in which the game was played. A lot of war gamers were very educated people. Mm-hmm. Do you think something has been lost by role-playing games kind of straying away from this kind of historical focused scholarly approach to this is how we write these games, this is how we play these games?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people who come up with really interesting ideas that you know, aren't in an academic frame of reference at all. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, my short answer is everybody has something to add if they love the game and they can communicate on paper.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that would be my first sort of comment. Now, like I go about things as an academic would, because that's what I know works. Mm-hmm. And I love to like really roll up my sleeves and get into detail. Mm-hmm. And I really, it's all really layered. So, you know, I start with the basic idea. I do a great deal. I make it like a preliminary bibliography. I do the lit review, and I go work through the questions. So I've got an idea of where I want to go, but how I'm going to get there is subject to that journey of the secondary sources that I'm going to go into. And those could be historical. They could be archaeological. They could be within the TSR gaming, broadly defined. And so I'll go and I'll do all that reading. And then what do I want to bring forward into the vision that I have? What do I want to leave behind? You know, what was a sort of a bad idea? What was a good idea? And I do try to always give respect to the people that worked at TSR, because any problem that we might encounter in sort of an OSR frame of reference or sort of design problem, they already encountered. You know, they figured a lot of things out.
Oh yeah.
Now, and most of the time I agree with them. Now, when I do disagree, it's going to be because I want something that's a little bit faster at the table, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I think a more streamlined way of doing things, but I don't run into that too often, because those guys were pretty bright and they definitely came up with great ways of solving problems and putting the game forward. So I do try to give respect to those people, because when I go back and I'm like, okay, well, I've got this situation. I remember something like this in a module. I'll go back and I'll read it, or I'll go back to one of the rule books and I'll consider what was put in there. And, you know, they had a lot of things figured out. So, yeah. And I'm a big advocate that, you know, Dungeons & Dragons is and gaming is at its best when it's simple, when it's streamlined, and you don't have to have a lot of pointy bits. Those things can slow things down. And it's something I have to remind myself of, because sometimes I can get carried away too. So I do try to think in simple terms when I can.
Mm-hmm. And now that we're kind of on that subject, I do have to ask, because I've had multiple people ask me in anticipation of this episode, how does a professor end up teaching a course on role-playing games?
Mm-hmm. Well, so what happens is, if anybody's unfamiliar, so I'll just assume no knowledge. One of the first things that at a university they want you to do is to bring your research or publishing into your classroom, so that you're keeping your classes as current and up to date as you can. So if normally we have research programs that will last, it could last a whole career, but generally you're looking in 7-year cycles. And you're looking at a 7-year cycle because you'll have normally 6 full years of teaching, and then you'll have a sabbatical year where you aren't teaching, but you're responsible to produce a book or publication of some type. And that's sort of like the culminating activity to that 7-year cycle. And then once you come off your sabbatical, you've got another 7-year cycle, and so on and so on. And, you know, over a 30-year career, you really only get maybe, you know, 3 or 4 of those. So you want to make them count. So when I did my PhD dissertation on British big game hunters in the Canadian West in the 1840s to the 1860s. And so once that research program was finished, I really wanted to go back to nostalgia and fantasy role-playing games. And then, so I got into some research on that subject in 2009, 2010, 2011. And then I just was creating Barrow Maze for my own group. The PDF publishing market was happening. People were working with the OGL quite a bit more. And then I thought, well, why don't I just make a game of my own? I'll take the game that we're playing at the table and bring it forward. And things have just taken off from there.
Gotcha. Now, Barrow Maze is an interesting product, one, because of the historical connections that we've already discussed, but also it's a mega dungeon. And there aren't a lot of mega dungeons, which is kind of unusual when, you know, anyone who's read the AD&D GM's guide has seen, you know, like a dungeon should have at least 12 levels. A lot of the rules seem to indicate mega dungeon play. However, it just never seemed to work out that there were many mega dungeons published. So, you know, what kind of drew you to the idea of mega dungeons as a concept in your role-playing games?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Barrow Maze was a response to what I didn't like about TSR published mega dungeons. So, so you can think of like Undermountain, let's start with Undermountain.
Yeah.
Like it's a really cool name. The fact that it's under a city isn't cool. And the presentation didn't make it easy on the game master.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got these maps, which are pretty neat. And then tables and tables. But unless you're a really experienced DM, you might not know how to pull it all together. So Barrow Maze was a response to a couple of different things. First was that, you know, there weren't a lot of themed mega dungeons. Hmm. They were kind of like all sort of a mishmash, sort of smorgasbord thing, different things on every level and so on. But nothing that really pulled it all together. So that was the first thing. The second thing was I wanted it detailed from start to finish so that the DM's job is done. And then the last one would be the concept. So you mentioned like the 12 tiered levels.
Yeah.
That's like really predictable. And, and that was okay when we were 10 or 15, but we've all experienced all that. We've read all that stuff. We've probably played in adventures like it, like Temple of Elemental Evil, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's just time for some alternative ways of thinking through the mega dungeon. So I used the phrase a dungeon sprawl rather than dungeon crawl or meaning like tiered levels. So I wanted the opportunity where you didn't have the staircase marking, okay, this is down to level 2 and this is down to level 3 and so on. I wanted people to potentially walk into from the first level area into the third level area, or from the first to the second to the fourth or something like that, so that it wouldn't be as predictable.
Yeah.
So those were some of the basic design approaches, things that I had in mind when I wanted to sort of bring it forward.
Mm-hmm. And that outlook on designing the dungeon fits very naturally with the barrow concept, because like you mentioned, some of these barrows are randomly kind of interconnected with each other.
Yeah. And, you know, looking across the UK, so you can see examples of plundered barrows that were sort of either somebody tried to break into the tombstone or the coverstone, I should say, or they tried to plunder it from above, where they literally would dig a hole and then try to pull the stones out to get access. So then you've got covered mounds that haven't been excavated yet. So I felt like that was a real opportunity to diversify the barrows. And I always like to try to provide some low-hanging fruit for, you know, first level adventurers, give them like the 15-minute dungeon crawl day and gain some experience and maybe pick up some items that can help them and carry on from there.
Mm-hmm. Now we have a question here from Rex Teal in chat. In your opinion, what do you think was the best mega dungeon published by TSR?
Well, I don't think there's one that's outstanding. I don't think the concept was ever really done well. But I would probably have to go with the Temple of Elemental Evil, because it's pretty much addressed, except for perhaps the elemental nodes like at the bottom. So I would probably say that, because I was never a huge fan of just maps and charts. I liked some of the Undermountain modules quite a bit. I thought some of those are actually pretty cool. Like the world's largest dungeon, for example, it was just maps and tables, really. It was bare bones. I didn't really see that as useful. Like Myth Draenor was kind of interesting, that box set, but at the same time, again, it's just too bare bones. There's not enough there to really work with. Or the other question is there enough to riff? Like, so if from what you see or what's presented, is there enough for you to bring your creative juices and then riff off that base? And sometimes there was and sometimes there wasn't. So I'd probably say Temple of Elemental Evil, if you had to pin me down.
Now, kind of building off your answer there, I have to ask, do you think the concept of the mega dungeon was really more of like the germ of an idea that Gygax had that he didn't either prioritize fully pursuing or just, you know, didn't think he needed to further pursue?
I don't know. Isn't it interesting though that the history of the hobby is based in the mega dungeon, and yet we never really got a terrific one?
Yeah.
Like I think that's always, there's been some consternation amongst the grognards, amongst us that, you know, it's kind of frustrating that, you know, we hear all these interesting things about, you know, Castle Greyhawk and so on and so forth, but we never actually got to experience it. But having said that, I think there's enough there for us to extrapolate, to say, all right, well, it is an opportunity for a bit of a tent pole to your campaign. It is an opportunity. People are busy. So most of the prep work can be done in advance. And then you're just worried about sort of facilitating at the table. So I know that's one of the main reasons why Barrel Maze came about with my home group, is that we would talk about in chat, you know, or email or whatever, what are we going to do that week? And then we'd show up on Friday night to play and they'd change their minds. So that was kind of frustrating. So it was nice to have that tentpole dungeon where people could keep going back to it, and it saves the DM prep time.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely become one of those things where, you know, there's a handful of people like yourself, and then, Rocky Gardner from Silver Boulets is also very interested in the concept of mega dungeons. It's one of those things that's become kind of like an interesting puzzle for a lot of people to figure out. Like, how do you make this concept work in a way that your players find interesting and that they want to keep coming back to?
Right. And so Rocky's my right hand man. So, you know, he and I, he's always interested to see what I send him for layout. Mm-hmm. He's great to work with. So if anybody wants to work with Rocky, I definitely recommend that. I just think, you know, we're all our minds are colonized because of TSR D&D. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, that's okay, because it gives us all the same frame of reference, right? When we were coming up, we were all playing the same modules. And then if you spoke to somebody you hadn't met, but was a D&D gamer, you could say, oh, did you remember what happened in White Plume Mountain or whatever? We had a communal sort of experience. That's hard, so much harder to do now, because, you know, we've had this golden age of the OSR, and people are publishing great stuff. And then, of course, you can overlap different editions or variations or clones or whatever. And it's harder to have that sort of communal experience. So one of the things I am very pleased about is that Barrel Maze is one of those touchstone experiences in the OSR. So even if you didn't spend a whole lot of time in there, somebody ran it at some point in the last 10 years. And so that's sort of gratifying, and it does speak to that the dungeon resonated with people, and I'm really pleased most about that, because it was coming from a place of love of the game and an interest in history, and to bring all and a personal touch as well, and to bring that to the gaming table. Because I think, like, there are a couple of examples where Barrow Mounds get used sort of obliquely or tangentially in TSR stuff, but nothing that was really wholly in the realm of Barrow Fields and Barrow Mounds. So I think sometimes when you go back and you look at old stuff, or if you're thinking about a publishing idea, look for the spaces, you know, where something's maybe touched on just off superficially, but could be a great main adventure idea. And sometimes when we go with those secondary sources and we're thinking in those terms, we can find little opportunities to fill a niche that hasn't been done before.
Yeah, and a lot of those, I think a lot of those kind of tangential appearances of Barrow type locations come as a result of Barrows being very briefly explored in like Lord of the Rings. And that's about the extent that a lot of writers kind of went into, okay, this is, you know, the Barrow is that thing that happened early on in the Fellowship of the Ring.
You're exactly right. So for me, if it gets referenced by Gygax or by one of the, you know, TSR folks, and it's happening in Lord of the Rings or, you know, in Tolkien's work broadly defined, if it's in both spots, so then it needs to be in your D&D game.
Yeah.
So that's how you know that you're in that sweet spot. Now, the hard part is, how do you take something that's really evocative to the imagination based on Tolkien and his knowledge of Anglo-Saxon history and language and his creative writing, and but then gamifying it within you know, a D&D or sort of frame of reference? That's, I think, the sweet spot for me. So, you know, I have great admiration and respect for the original texts of Tolkien and for Gygax bringing the game forward. So, you know, when you can find those sweet spots, then you know you're usually in a good place.
Absolutely. Now, Sequoia Wright here in chat has a lot of high praise for Barrow Maze, saying the theme and tone of Barrow Maze absolutely drips with mystery, fascination, and danger. The lethality of the BX rule set and clones make it an excellent example of the mythic underworld style. So with Sequoia's praise there in mind, when it comes to introducing people who are otherwise unfamiliar with Barrow Maze, what's kind of the hook, the thing that's bringing the players to explore these burial mounds within the adventure itself?
Well, in my games, I always, it's a low fantasy style where people are playing tomb robbers, mm-hmm. and so you know, usually they're I kind of see adventurers as gladiators in ancient Rome, from the standpoint that they're lauded for their heroism on one hand, but they're viewed as abhorrent on one hand because they're selling their bodies.
Yeah.
So I see adventurers the same way. They don't want to actually work for a living, and they'll engage occasionally in heroic deeds, but you only if there's gold on the other side of it. So yeah, they have like this strange space in society in my game, mm-hmm. and I think that kind of setting makes the tomb robbing very interesting. So that's kind of where I come from and how I sort of situate. And then when you're dealing with, so the undead, I think, are one of the really terrific and horrifying monsters in Dungeons & Dragons. And we're all a bit normalized to it. Oh yeah, there's some skeletons, there are some zombies, you know, a ghoul or a ghast or whatever. But if you're thinking of the experience of it in that moment to people who have maybe heard of these things but not actually seen them, and then you try to bring it to life in those terms, then I think you're creating a really exciting play experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the terrifyingness of the undead has definitely been lost in kind of like modern games. I recently ran people through a Castles and Crusades scenario where they encountered 1d12 wights because they decided to sleep in the dungeon. And they quickly realized just exactly how terrifying the concept of losing a level every time you're hit is.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's supposed to be terrifying. And So, you know, that's why I think I was trying to, I really did a good thorough survey of all the different undead types and then where I wanted to use them. And it's also too, it's about what Barrow Maze does is it takes the cleric and it puts the spotlight on the cleric. And so you need to really think in terms of, I wanted turning undead to be a bit more of a resource management thing, not like a technology that you can just flip on and off like a switch. I wanted the turning to be part of the resource management, and I wanted the cleric to be put on the hot seat. And it's just completely natural and organic when you're thinking in terms of the undead in that context.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And again, because we're dealing with the folklore and the history of the British Isles, there's lots of kind of weird, interesting things that you can play with as far as undead go. I mean, how many people know where the concept of the headless horseman from the Sleepy Hollow stories come from? That comes from Irish folklore. That's the Dillahan. And that's the kind of thing that you can have your players come up against in these scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. Folklore and myth is a great starter. So, you know, I'm doing background reading for the next Mega Dungeon project, which is years away. But I'm starting. So I've got a whole line of books, and I've got a whole section that's just children's folklore. And mm-hmm. I will work up from that all the way into historical journals and most recent archaeology, all the way up and through. And then in the gaming related material that's been published previously. And I'll work through all of that. And I think that, children's folk tales and children's fairy tales were a big part of the original creation and inspiration for Dungeons & Dragons. So that's viable a source of creativity for you as anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And fantasy itself is born out of children's stories. I mean, as I've explored kind of the roots of where the fantasy genre came from, it all leads back to Arthurian romance and Robin Hood child ballads. Mm-hmm. So there's these aspects of stories meant for children that carry over into even the most sophisticated fantasy story that you have today.
Sure. You know, and a lot of the stories that we've been telling ourselves as human beings, you know, it predates writing. The music that accompanies it predates musical notation. So, you know, a great example would be, you know, many proto Indo-European cultures had some version of a sky father deity. Mm-hmm. And so when you're standing on top of one of those hills and you're in the Neolithic and you're burning the body of your father or your grandfather on a funeral pyre, and you're standing there under the moon as these little embers are of your father are literally floating up into the sky, and you can see very well how that would have been later co-opted by Christianity to the Heavenly Father and that sort of thing. Like, it was literally these older traditions were overwritten by Christianity and incorporated. And that's why in a lot of like at the Hill of Tara, for example, there's a church plunked right on the Hill of Tara. It was to overwrite the older traditions and incorporate those older traditions. So there's a lot of really interesting history to go on there. And I think that's kind of interesting to incorporate that. Like if you're thinking like a God of Righteousness or something like that would probably do that in the context of a gaming world as well. Like if you're thinking you have a dynamic of old gods and new, which I do in my games.
Yep. Yeah. And even you can see how the earliest kind of, you know, missionaries or bishops, people like St. Patrick, who go into these places and are trying to explain concepts of their faith to these people using the things around them or the things that they hold sacred to explain your ideas. You can see how these things kind of mesh together and how, these ideas kind of form into one over time.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I'm a Highland bagpiper. So, you know, my musical tradition predates musical notation. Mm-hmm. And what would happen is the music would be chanted from mentor to learner, and you as the learner would learn that chant, and the sounds of the chant correspond to finger movements. So, you know, that's how it was done. And And so when you know, I do try to keep those kind of things in mind, and it's helpful. It's really helpful because you're trying to take, you've been colonized by playing TSR D&D for so long. We're so far removed from those agrarian sort of roots and an understanding of the cycle and phases of the moon and what that would mean and the meanings and culture around it. And sometimes it's nice to, if you can, to do some broader reading. It's helpful in that regard.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. It's a thing that not a lot of people know how to do anymore, and that's place yourself mentally in a different period of time where so much of the thing, like so many of the things you take for granted around you and so many of the things that you rely on day to day don't exist and won't exist for thousands of years. A lot of people don't have the imagination to envision, okay, what's it like, with the concept of written language not necessarily being something that everyone has? What's it like with, predating musical notation or, predating certain religious practices or certain... Most people aren't even able to fathom that because it's outside of the familiar. Right. And so anything that gets you closer to putting yourself in a different mindset really helps kind of build the immersion in these games.
Oh, I completely agree. And, I'm not saying that we can ever really accomplish that intellectually, but right. What I am saying is if you're inside one of these barrows and like, which I was, mm-hmm. and you just sit there, just absorb it. What does it feel like? What does it mean to have this structure oriented to the winter solstice and, one day a year that sun beams right into the back of that chamber where the remains were placed?
Yeah.
And because the barrow represents... It's the interstice. It's that space between life and death.
Yep.
And if we think in very simple terms, if we think in terms of the sun and its warmth as life, mm-hmm. and the moon and darkness and the cold as death, and we can think of that on a daily cycle, but then we can think of it in a seasonal cycle, then we can think of it in an annual cycle, right?
Yeah.
That we've got the grow season, right? So when you've got the winter solstice, after that, the days are going to start getting longer. When you've got the summer solstice, the days are going to start getting shorter. And these are things you had to prepare for and you had to think about. And so those are important considerations, especially when and they strike you when you're sitting inside that barrow that was built 5,000, 700 years ago. Mm-hmm. And how on earth did they carry all the stone up there? So like one of the places I went was, the climb was 2,200 feet and it was just, and it commanded the whole landscape. It was really striking. It was really, really striking. There are great opportunities, and it doesn't even have to be Neolithic. It could be, I went in a couple Norman castles as well. Mm-hmm. Which I enjoy. I just prefer the Neolithic stuff, if I'm going to spend my time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. You mentioned the idea of the sun being life-giving, or representing life to many of these people. The notion of life is only visible for one day a year in this chamber that represents a gateway between this world and the afterlife. That's an interesting concept as well, and one that really kind of makes you think. One that really makes you kind of, ponder the implications of what exactly that means.
Right. And so one of the barrows that I went to at the back, so right at the back where the remains were placed, there was a petroglyph of a sun. And, you know, someone wanted there to be light, or at least the symbol of light and warmth, above the remains of their ancestor locked in death and darkness in that tomb. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that strikes you. Like, there was a human being at some point that all that long ago that wanted to make sure that their ancestor had some little bit of light, of life, of warmth in their eternal sleep. So, you know, those are really, really cool things to consider.
Rex Teal wants to know if you found any treasure in those barrows. And I believe we already mentioned Roman coins. So there's your answer.
I didn't find any. I mean, the treasure for me was looking for glyphs. So, you know, you'll get like, you can get triangles. You can get like a lozenge, which is like a diamond shape. Pardon me. Everything's pretty well geometric. So you'll get, you know, the circles as well as sometimes squares that do the same thing. But if you're thinking about Ireland, so, you know, the major initial agricultural settlements were in the west in Sligo. And then that migrates a couple hundred years later, you get like the Low Crew Cairns, or Loch Crew, I should say, Cairns. But there aren't really any petroglyphs in the west. But once you get to the center a couple hundred years later, you start to see them. And then once you get to Nowth, Dowth, and Newgrange in the east, it's an explosion of petroglyphs. So you've got more megalithic art in the Boyne Valley than you do in all of Europe combined for that time period.
Yeah, so Rex, he's not going to go down there and find Fragara. I believe what we're saying here.
Yeah, the treasure was in the experience.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And I like that's a great treasure to find down there, especially like you mentioned, just that massive collection of you know, Neolithic art. It's something you wouldn't have otherwise found unless you actually went and explored there. It's something you can only see in that location. It's not like a painting that can tour. You have to go find it and seek it out. There's something special about that.
Yeah, if there was for me, and you know, I had pretty much locked in the sites that I wanted to go see, and then you know, once I got the cairns and the barrows sort of out of the way, then it was on to standing stones. So I hit some really terrific standing stone locations. Ardgroom, Drombeg, for example, set within that beautiful sort of landscape with the hills and everything else, and you can look up sort of the astrological positions of those circles before you go, and then you can pull. I just pulled my compass up on my iPhone, and took a look at it. Okay, so they would have been standing about here. The solstice would have been here, or relative to this hill. Or oftentimes, like you'll get hills like this, so the sun would be coming down right in between those two hills, and then stuff like that would be planned, right? So, so they knew exactly what they were doing, and that's really terrific to think about. And the engineering, again, not really having beasts of burden per se, just doing it with large men, with the benefit of agriculture, to create a population size big enough to build these things.
Yep. And Cal, that's Fragara the Answerer, not Fraggle Rock. Although the doozers being present would explain the construction that you see.
I love those. Those are my favorite little dudes, the guys with the construction hats.
Yep. Yep. And Diversity and Dragons, first of all, welcome. And secondly, yes, Cal, you're dunderheaded lummox. Now, another aspect of kind of Barrow Maze is this is an award-winning adventure at this point. You've won not one, but two Three Castles Awards, which are given out, for those of you who don't know, that award is given out every year at North Texas RPG Convention. So how did you first start going to North Texas, and when did you first start kind of, you know, finding yourself in consideration for that award?
I think the first year that I went to North Texas was 2012, perhaps, somewhere around there anyway. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to, because I was reading at the time, or the years leading up to that, reading blogs and so on and so forth. And there are people, some of the original TSR game designers, people involved in Dragon Magazine and so on. These are people I'd, of course, read about many times, and I wanted to be able to play with them or watch their games and see what their DM style was like relative to mine. And it was very gratifying those first few times when I was watching those games and echoing the same kinds of things that we did around our table. So that was pretty cool. And then learning new things and new ways of presenting or with addressing players at the table. So that's one of the main reasons why I went there. And then, of course, meeting Bad Mike and the rest of the folks that go regularly to North Texas it was just like an immediate family atmosphere. If anybody hasn't gone and you have a chance to go, you know, definitely go to North Texas, because it's the epicenter of the OSR at this stage.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. And when he says that there are like people from classic TSR there, it's not like they're off, you know, hiding somewhere. It's you go to the hotel bar and you turn and Zeb Cook is standing next to you. That's the level of mixture you have with just all the people there. Like, you know, I mean, this year I got to meet Zeb because Bill Barsh introduced me. So, you know, it really is just a great environment for anyone who loves old school gaming or who appreciates their gaming history. That's the convention you want to go to.
Yeah. And, you know, especially at North Texas, like special guests are not, you know, locked away in rooms where you never get to meet them. As you pointed out, everybody's right there. You just stick your hand right out there, meet somebody, introduce yourself, say hello, and things carry on from there. So yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah. And then your first win for the Three Castles Award was 2018, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then of course you won this most recent year. Were those both for Barrel Maze related products, or, you know, what was your win for each of them?
So 2018 was Archaea, the Forbidden Caverns of Archaea. Mm-hmm. And the most recent one was Duero Deep.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So they're all situated in my game world. And so that leans on the outdoor survival map on which Gygax situated Castle Greyhawk, so the story goes. So they didn't really have like a hex map, so they used a board game called Outdoor Survival. And so it's you know, you can look that up if you're not familiar with it. That's basically the long and the short of it. And, you know, I'm very, very fortunate and thankful that the judges, you know, like those two. And as long as people keep supporting me, I'll keep making them.
Hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, the outdoor survival thing, a lot of people don't realize, or at least a lot of people my age don't realize, when D&D started, it wasn't just D&D. You also had to have chainmail for combat, and then you had to have outdoor survival for the travel between dungeons. So when you talk about D&D in the very earliest stages, it's actually three separate games combined into one.
Yeah, well, I found the map to be it's kind of evocative. And to think that, you know, we talked about Castle Greyhawk a little bit earlier, like you've got these suggestions, of course, and nothing was actually really published worth playing. So then you've okay, well, we know that the outdoor survival map was used, and we've got these, you know, sort of levels and so on and so forth. So we're taking those ideas, the tenets of what we know was put forward, and we're extrapolating and trying to keep that notion of the mega dungeon part of the hobby.
Mm-hmm. And then Double D has a question here. You mentioned before we went on air that you're working on your own rule set. How is that going? What has that project been like for you so far?
So, I am, if people aren't aware, I'm working on a rule set. So this is halfway between BX and an AD&D. And it's the home game that I've been running for a long time. So that, like, if you grew up playing BX and AD&D when they came out, what happened was simply this. BX was kind of distilled and much more comprehensible. So you're playing that first, and that made sense. Then we got AD&D, and it had a lot of stuff that bogged the game down. Needless rules like weapon speed factors and things of that nature that weren't fun. So what you did is you incorporated your AD&D books into your game, but you were effectively playing with the BX engine. So you had the Chrome grafted onto BX rather than playing AD&D as written. And a lot of people played that way, or a version very, very close to it. And that's the version that that I kept playing. And then when we played, I played enough second edition to know that, well, that's not the game I want to play either. I hate weapon proficiencies, things of that nature. And then, you know, I played some third edition as well, and that was definitely not the game I wanted to play. So I just kept playing the version that I played. So the rule set is effectively that, and it's going to have it's the home game that I've been running, the home game that inspired Barrow Maze, that inspired the other games I've done. And it's going to look, you can expect the same production quality from my adventures in the rule book. So I just got a completed full page piece from Darlene, which is super, super awesome. The cover's pretty great. And I'm just, I've got the spell section, the monster section, and the magic items constitute about 150,000 words on their own. So it's going to be like a player's handbook and DM guide combined.
Nice.
But I'm going to try to keep the other sections on under 50,000 words, so it's no more than 200,000 words. Because there are a couple things I really dislike. I dislike digest size books, and I dislike splat books. Mm-hmm. So I've got, what I want to be able to do is, I don't want to, when I'm creating games, I don't want to be beholden to somebody else's rule set. So if that person flakes out or isn't supporting their game, then I can just do my own thing, and I'll make it available to other people if they want to write supplements or adventures for, and keep it all very simple and very straightforward. And you can expect that to happen as early as March of 2024.
Nice. Yeah, there's there's a fine line between, you know, having a bunch of different books, a bunch of different splat books, like you mentioned, that can be very annoying, and then having a book that you can use to beat someone to death with, like Dave Beatty's Weird Frontiers.
Right. So, and he would, let's face it.
Yes.
So I like Dave. He's super fun.
Dave's a great guy.
Yeah.
I think I was actually talking to Dave when I met you. So
Yeah, Dave's good. He's a good time and always good for a laugh. But I think you're right. So what I'm doing is I'm shooting for something that's more comprehensive than a BX rule book. All the needless words have been omitted or cut, removed, and it's brass tacks right down to the point. What does the DM need to know to facilitate? What do the players need to know? And then incorporated with some really terrific art. So Kenan James has done, I think, like 85 illustrations for this thing. He's done the demons and devils section, which is killer. Like it's really kick ass. So I'm excited for everybody to see that. He's done the illustrations for all the classes. So there'll be consistency. You know, when you go to each section, you're going to see similar art for each of those sections. So there's it's all sort of pulled together. And I'm super, super excited about it. All the sections I've been sending off for proofreading and editing with people I trust, and I've gotten some good feedback so far. So I'm incorporating that feedback, and then I've got outlines for the rest of the sections. So it's just a matter of writing those.
Gotcha. Well, we are running up on our time limit for today. So there's one more question everyone gets asked when they come on Rollin' Bones. The answer to this question can be as philosophical or as sophomoric as you want it to be. But Greg, if you could put anything on a t-shirt, what would it be?
I can put anything on a t-shirt. So we're talking something gaming related. Is that how it goes?
Anything on a t-shirt.
I think one of the things I like most on a t-shirt might be something like speak truth to power.
Okay.
So, you know, we all have our truth, no matter what your point of view may be. And that's great. And speak your truth. And don't be shy to speak your truth either. So it doesn't matter the context. You know, if you have conviction for who you are and conviction for what you believe, whether it's gaming or whether it's something else, then you speak truth to power.
Absolutely. Well, like I said, we are at the end of our time. I know, you don't like to, you know, come on shows like this and do just a massive sales pitch, but I do want to show everyone your drive-through page where you can get all of Greg's adventures. I'm going to drop the link here in chat, and I will put the link in the pinned comment on YouTube after this is done. This is where you can get Duero Deep, you can get Barrow Maze Complete, everything that Greg's done you can find here on Drive-Thru. And Greg, thank you for coming on and thank you for discussing this with me. This has been a great conversation. I love anytime we can bring real history into the game. I appreciate it. So, you know, thank you for joining me this evening and talking about it.
It's my pleasure. And thanks for everybody joining in the chat. And if you'd like to have me back on at some point, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Next time you have a project or, you know, any kind of topic you want to discuss, just let me know and we'll bring you on.
Oh, great. I appreciate that.
Cool. Well, guys, that's going to do it for Rollin' Bones this evening. Next week, there will not be a show. Next week is Independence Day here in the U.S., generally, not a lot of people are watching streams. I've got plans, so we're just not going to do Rollin' Bones next week. On the 11th, though, I mentioned at the top of the show, we're not talking about drama. On the 11th, we are. I will have the Basic Expert and Victor Gorchev on, and we are going to be talking all about everything that's happened over the past few weeks. We're going to be talking about focusing on the game, moving past squabbles and purity tests and all this stuff, and really just focusing on making fun games and designing great products that people want to play and that get them excited about gaming and get them wanting to make their own games. So that's what we'll be doing on July 11th when Rollin' Bones returns. Until then, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time.